It began like a whisper. On a humid night in late August 2023, a man named Robert Hensley sat alone in a dim apartment outside Phoenix, watching his computer screen bleed red. One by one, the digital numbers that once promised freedom, retirement, a boat, the down payment for his daughter's college, dissolved into zeros. The cursor blinked like a pulse giving up. The television murmured from the corner. Federal investigators report a record $5.6 billion lost to cryptocurrency fraud this year. Robert didn't hear the rest. He just sat there, lit by the cold light of a market that never slept. Across the country, similar screens flickered in kitchens, bedrooms, dorms, and offices. Some cried. Some cursed. Most said nothing at all. They just watched their faith in a new kind of wealth turn into smoke. That night, America learned the cruel truth about the digital dream. It could vanish without a sound. Chapter 1, The Surge. The year was 2023, and the promise of easy money had never felt so near. Crypto wasn't just a word anymore, it was a culture. It was the air inside coffee shops, the chatter at barbershops, the sermon of online prophets who sold certainty in the form of financial freedom. Screens glowed like altars, and millions came to worship. The market had cooled since its manic highs, but a strange confidence had replaced the chaos. Regular people, teachers, small business owners, even retirees, began believing this was their second chance. The dollar was weakening, inflation was climbing, and digital coins seemed immune to the old rules. Robert Hensley had been one of them. He was 54, a man who had once built houses for a living until the 2008 crash tore his savings apart. He had rebuilt slowly, drywall by drywall, until crypto arrived and promised him a new start without the dust and sweat. When he opened his first trading app in January, the interface felt too easy, too friendly, bright colors, clean fonts, a small green arrow that always seemed to be pointing up. Scene 1, the dream. The first deposit was modest, $500. By March, it was $5,000. By June, he'd wired in his entire savings, $38,412, to a platform run by a man he'd met on a Facebook group for retiree investors. The man's name was Cal, though his accent didn't quite fit the photo of the smiling Texas businessman he claimed to be. Cal's messages came every morning, always polite, always reassuring. Good morning, Robert. Market looks strong today. Keep faith. Your portfolio up 12% this week. Proud of you. We'll hit your target before Christmas, guaranteed. Robert liked that word, guaranteed. It felt old-fashioned, like a handshake in a world of passwords. He told his sister in Ohio he was finally catching a break. He told his daughter, Emily, that she'd never have to worry about student loans. Every night, he checked his balance before bed like a man counting blessings. He didn't know that the numbers were fake. He didn't know that somewhere in Cambodia, behind a locked gate and rows of guarded dormitories, a young woman named May was typing those same reassuring messages under Cal's name. Scene 2, the machine. May had been promised a marketing job. She arrived in Sihanoukville from Shenzhen with a suitcase, a passport, and a hope that her English would finally pay off. Instead, she found herself in a glass-walled office where guards carried tasers and employees slept in bunks stacked three high. Her task was simple: convince Westerners to invest. Each scammer controlled 10 to 20 online personas. Photos were stolen from real people. The scripts were pre-written. The bonuses came when a victim deposited new funds. They called it pig butchering, a grotesque term for a patient, emotional slaughter. Fatten the victim with affection, promises, and shared dreams before the final cut. May didn't think of it that way. She told herself it was just customer service. She didn't see the faces, only the text. She typed what the software told her to type. Robert, your account growing faster than forecast. Don't miss the window. Each message fed the illusion. The platform's graphs danced convincingly. The chat never slept. Scene 3, the data storm. By mid-2023, complaints began flooding into the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, IC3, faster than analysts could categorize them. 45% increase in crypto-related scams year over year. Over $5.6 billion gone. They mapped the data on a screen in Quantico, red dots across every state. Los Angeles, Miami, Chicago, Austin. Thousands of victims who thought they were investing, dating, or even helping a friend move funds. Agent Clara Mendez, who had spent a decade tracing financial crimes, looked at the numbers and felt the weight of something new. The old frauds had limits, wire transfers, stolen checks, identity theft. But this one, it was borderless, faceless, frictionless. "They're not robbing banks anymore," she said quietly to her partner. "They've built new ones in people's phones." Every file told the same story. Victims transferred everything, homes, retirements, children's tuition, into thin air. And because the blockchain recorded every transaction publicly, the cruelty was permanent. Their loss lived forever, etched into digital stone. Scene 4, the chorus of the lost. Across the nation, the voices echoed. A teacher in Kansas City who lost $70,000. A nurse in Seattle who mortgaged her condo. A widower in Florida who thought a woman named Elena truly loved him. Each spoke to journalists, sometimes through tears, sometimes through clenched anger. They wanted someone to see them, to understand that it wasn't greed, it was trust. Television anchors used words like epidemic, crime wave, financial contagion. But for those living inside it, it was quieter, like drowning in plain sight. Robert watched one of those news reports in early August. The FBI spokesperson mentioned something about foreign criminal syndicates leveraging romance and investment scams. He turned off the TV before the commercial break, uneasy but unwilling to believe he'd been fooled. His balance still looked fine. The numbers were still green. He told himself, if it were a scam, it would have crashed by now. That was how most of them stayed trapped, halfway between suspicion and hope. Scene 5, the crack. The first real crack came on a Sunday night. The withdrawal button didn't work. Robert clicked it again. Nothing. Then again. A message popped up. Temporary network delay. Please try again later. He tried again later. Same message. He messaged Cal. Hey, I can't withdraw. System upgrade. Cal replied within seconds. All good tomorrow. Tomorrow never came. By Tuesday, the website was gone. His balance page turned into a blank white screen. The chat thread disappeared. His heart raced, his fingers shaking over the keyboard like a man trying to hold water. He called his bank. They told him the wires had cleared weeks ago to a series of accounts routed through Hong Kong. Nothing they could do. For hours, Robert sat frozen. Outside, the desert night hummed with the low whine of crickets and distant traffic. Inside, his world shrank to that one glowing screen, a tombstone of numbers. Scene 6, the silence. In the weeks that followed, the noise grew everywhere else. The Federal Trade Commission released a statement. The FBI updated its annual report. Lawmakers held hearings. Charts filled with statistics. But for the people like Robert, the aftermath was silence. There were no refunds, no arrests, no justice that reached them. He filed a complaint online. It took 5 minutes. A form letter came back thanking him for his submission. That was all. Emily called him one evening, worried. He told her he was fine. He wasn't. He sold his pickup truck to cover bills. He started working again part-time at a construction site, the same kind of job he thought he'd left behind. At night, he still opened the browser out of habit, staring at the blank page where his fortune used to be. Some wounds heal in the body. Others keep blinking in memory, like a cursor on an empty screen. Closing beat, the new American heist. By the end of 2023, the headlines hardened into numbers. Crypto fraud tops $5.6 billion in reported losses. Romance investment hybrids on the rise. Victims describe emotional manipulation as sophisticated and relentless. The analysts spoke in percentages. The victims spoke in whispers. Some blamed themselves, others blamed the government. Most just stopped talking about it altogether. But in that quiet, something else began. A small group of cyber forensics teams and ex-victims who refused to let it rest. They started tracking stolen tokens across blockchains, tracing the ghosts of vanished wealth. In a warehouse in Virginia, Agent Mendez watched one of those traces resolve into a cluster of new addresses lighting up across Southeast Asia. She leaned forward, her eyes narrowing. "They're getting smarter," her partner said. She nodded. "So are we." And somewhere out there, across a continent and a sea, May sat in a new compound under a new name, staring at a new list of clients. For a moment, she hesitated before sending the first message. "Good evening, Robert. You still believe in opportunity." Her finger hovered over the enter key. Fade to black. Chapter 2, The Illusionists. Morning light spilled through the blinds of a rented office in Phnom Penh, slicing across rows of computers. On the screens were dashboards that looked perfectly legitimate, prices ticking up and down, green and red candles shifting, animated logos spinning in endless loops. To the untrained eye, it looked like any normal trading floor. To the people working there, it was something else entirely. Scene 1, the room of masks. May adjusted her headset and logged into the chat system. Her alias today was Lauren, a supposed financial consultant based in San Francisco. She'd already built for client relationships that month. The bosses called them projects. Across from her sat a dozen other workers, each speaking quietly into microphones, switching languages, smiling into cameras that hid everything but their performance. Some pretended to be men, some women, some lovers, some mentors. They were the illusionists, conjurers of digital affection and false security. The pay wasn't much, but the penalty for disobedience was worse. Guards stood by the door, their presence constant, reminding everyone that this wasn't a job, it was captivity disguised as employment. A supervisor walked the aisles, checking screens. He paused behind May, watching her cursor move. "Be warm," he said in Mandarin. "Americans trust warmth. Make him believe you're tired but hopeful." She nodded, forcing a soft smile before typing. "Hey Robert, I didn't sleep much last night. Markets keep me awake. But I think today will be a lucky one for us." She hesitated at the word "us," then hit send. Scene 2, the investigator. Back in Virginia, Special Agent Clara Mendez stared at a flow chart taped across her wall. It looked like a spider web made of money. Every line led to somewhere offshore: Hong Kong, Laos, the Seychelles, Dubai. The dots represented wallet addresses. The thicker ones were hubs of criminal traffic. Her team had been at this for months. Every time they froze one digital account, 5 new ones appeared. The language barrier, shell companies, and encrypted chat rooms made the work feel endless. She had joined the bureau to fight corruption in banks and corporations, but this was different. There were no banks to subpoena, no boardrooms to raid. Only data, cold, vast, and constantly shifting. Her partner, Agent Russo, handed her a coffee. "You hear about the new task force?" "Yeah. Treasury, Homeland, Interpol. It's growing. You think it'll matter?" "It has to," she said. "Otherwise, this becomes the new normal." They had one partial lead, a crypto exchange node that had touched dozens of fraud wallets before vanishing. The IP traced to Cambodia. Russo pointed to it with his pen. "You ever been to Phnom Penh?" "No," she said. "But it's time someone goes." Scene 3, the American front. In Los Angeles, a man named Trevor Briggs had built a company that promised high-yield blockchain investments for middle-class Americans. His office sat on the 12th floor of a mirrored tower, the kind that caught sunlight and looked righteous from the freeway. Inside, the walls were lined with motivational posters. "Your money, your freedom." Trevor wore sharp suits and spoke softly, the way pastors do when they want your trust. He wasn't a hacker. He was a bridge, a clean American face between the offshore scammers and the local investors who needed convincing. He'd partnered with a network of consultants who received commissions for referrals. Some knew the game, others didn't. They sold dreams to neighbors, co-workers, church friends. Trevor called it democratizing access. When regulators asked for documents, he provided them: fake audits, fake legal opinions, fake letters from non-existent banks. The illusion was total. On paper, his operation looked legitimate. But behind the scenes, his systems funneled money straight to foreign accounts. For every dollar wired overseas, a new platform rose to replace the last. He called it scaling the business. The Bureau called it laundering. Scene 4, Robert's descent. Robert Hensley was still in Arizona, trying to hold on to a semblance of normal life. The shock hadn't worn off. He kept replaying his steps, looking for the moment he should have known better, the message he ignored, the gut feeling he silenced. He filed his police report and heard nothing. He contacted his bank again, but the clerk sounded rehearsed. He joined a victims forum online. There, he met dozens of people who told the same story, line for line: the friendly mentor, the quick gains, the final silence. He realized how carefully it had been done. They didn't steal his money overnight. They made him believe he wanted to give it. Late one night, he printed every screenshot, every text, every email, and laid them across his kitchen table like puzzle pieces. He stared at them until sunrise, hoping they'd form a picture that made sense. All he saw was his own trust reflected back at him. Scene 5, the factory of faces. May's team had grown efficient. The room now handled over 100 clients simultaneously. Artificial intelligence tools generated new profiles, complete with photos, accents, and social histories. A man down the row named Ping showed her how to run 5 conversations at once. "They don't need truth," he whispered. "They need attention. Give them comfort. They'll give you everything." The words sank like stones in her stomach. She had stopped thinking of them as victims. It was easier that way. But sometimes, a line would cut through her routine. That evening, one of her targets wrote, "You remind me of my wife before she passed. The way you talk, it brings her back." May froze. She looked at the photo beside the message, a tired man, gray-haired, sitting beside a Christmas tree. She almost replied with her real name. Instead, she typed the script's next line. "I'm glad I can make you feel warm again." She clicked send, then whispered under her breath, "I'm sorry." Scene 6, the press conference. In Washington, D.C., cameras flashed as officials announced the creation of the Digital Asset Crime Task Force. A long name for a desperate idea. The Attorney General read the numbers aloud. In the past year alone, American citizens lost over $5.6 billion to crypto-related investment scams. These crimes are not committed by lone actors. They are industrialized, organized, and transnational. Reporters shouted questions. One asked about recovery. Another asked about prevention. Mendez watched from the back row, stone-faced. She knew that behind every statistic were hundreds of Roberts, quiet casualties of belief. After the briefing, she approached the podium. "We need boots in Southeast Asia," she told her director. "And we need them now." The director gave a weary nod. "You'll have them. But be careful. Those compounds aren't call centers. They're prisons." Scene 7, the raid. The night before the raid, May couldn't sleep. The compound had grown tense. Whispers of investigations, a supervisor missing, guards checking phones. She felt something shifting, like a storm crawling toward the city. At dawn, engines rumbled outside. The front gate exploded inward. Uniformed men flooded the hallway, shouting in languages she didn't understand. Guards dropped weapons. Workers screamed. Mendez stepped into the smoke, her badge hanging from her neck, flashlight cutting through dust. Rows of young faces stared back, frightened, exhausted, confused. She recognized the setup instantly. Rows of computers, English scripts pinned to walls, fake trading platforms running live demos. The illusion stripped bare. "Nobody moves," she shouted. "You're safe. Just stay seated." Safe was a relative term. Some had been captives, others complicit. Sorting one from the other would take months. On one screen still running, she saw a chat window open, a message sent just minutes earlier. It read, "Good morning, Robert. Market looks steady. Today could be our day." She stared at it, imagining the man on the other side, still waiting for an answer that would never come. Scene 8, the aftermath. News of the raid broke within hours. Headlines filled with words like rescued workers and international crackdown. Politicians praised cooperation. But beneath the applause, the truth was complicated. Hundreds were freed, yes. Yet thousands more operations still thrived across borders, too remote to reach. The machine had merely shifted shape. Back in the States, Robert read about it online. The article mentioned foreign scam compounds and American victims. He saw a photo of a young woman in handcuffs, her face half hidden behind hair. For reasons he couldn't explain, he felt no hatred, only a strange emptiness. He printed the article and placed it with his other papers. Another piece of a puzzle he no longer wanted to solve. Scene 9, the negotiator. Weeks later, Mendez sat across from May in a Cambodian detention center. The translator mediated their silence. "You wrote to a man named Robert Hensley," Mendez began. "You told him you were an investor. You took his savings." May didn't lift her eyes. "I followed instructions. You knew it was wrong." She hesitated. "I didn't think of him as real." Mendez slid a folder across the table. Inside was Robert's photo, smiling beside his daughter at a graduation ceremony. "He's real," she said quietly. "And so are you. Help us stop this." For a long moment, nothing moved. Then May whispered, "If I tell you names, can I go home?" Mendez didn't answer. She only said, "Start with the one who gave you the script." Scene 10, the ghost in the system. As weeks passed, Mendez's team traced new wallets that appeared right after the raid, evidence the syndicate was already rebuilding. The illusion had layers, fake investors, fake platforms, fake shutdowns. Every time one domain went dark, another appeared under a new name, a new flag, a new digital disguise. The code never slept. Back home, Robert began attending a support group for financial fraud victims. They met every Thursday in a church basement. There was no preaching, only stories, each one ending the same way. A promise, a loss, a lesson. He didn't talk much, but one night he said quietly, "They didn't steal money. They stole the part of me that believed people meant what they said." No one replied. They didn't need to. They all understood. Scene 11, the broadcast. Months later, a television network aired a documentary titled The Illusionists. It showed footage of the raid, interviews with survivors, and Mendez explaining how technology had turned fraud into theater. Robert watched from his couch, the same seat where he had once watched his savings disappear. When May appeared on screen, her face blurred, he leaned forward. "They used us like actors," her translated voice said. "We learned to say what people wanted to hear. We lived in a movie we couldn't leave." Robert turned off the TV and sat in silence. Through the window, he could see the city lights reflecting in his glass, tiny digital stars, bright and unreachable. He thought of all the people still out there, staring at their screens, waiting for luck to strike. The illusion was still alive, it just had new names. Closing beat, the mirror. Later that night, Robert logged into a new government awareness website. At the bottom of the page was a warning in bold letters. "If it feels too perfect, it probably isn't real." He smiled faintly. The line was simple, almost cliche, but it held something true. He shut the laptop and whispered to himself, "No more miracles." In a hotel room somewhere in Bangkok, a young recruiter opened a laptop filled with blank profiles, ready to build the next generation of fake investors. The faces began to load, smiling, trustworthy, flawless. The illusion continued, waiting for the next believer to look their way. Fade out. Chapter 3, The Reckoning. The winter of 2023 came quietly. No grand announcement. No dramatic shift in the world. Just colder mornings, slower evenings, and a public that had begun to understand something unsettling about the age they lived in. Money could move without hands. Lies could travel without voices. Trust could be stolen without a mask or a gun. America didn't erupt. It exhaled. And in that long breath, the truth settled like dust over everything. Scene 1, The Return. Robert Hensley sat at a folding table in the back of a modest community center, sorting pamphlets. He worked there part-time now, helping with financial literacy workshops funded by a local nonprofit. He didn't lead them. He wasn't ready for that. Instead, he replaced toner in printers, set up chairs, made coffee and stacked paper. Some would call it humble work. He welcomed it. Before people entered the room, he wiped each table carefully, as though clearing away invisible debris might protect someone else the way he wished someone had protected him. On a bulletin board near the door, a flyer read, "Crypto Awareness Night, Protect Yourself and Loved Ones." Below it, a handwritten note, "If you have experienced financial fraud, you're not alone." He read that line every time he passed it. Some days it hurt. Other days it helped. Scene 2, The Offer. After one workshop ended, a tall man with silver hair approached Robert. His voice was calm, the way teachers speak when they want to be gentle. "You lost money?" he asked. Robert nodded. "A lot." Robert didn't answer right away. Then, "Everything." The man exhaled slowly. His eyes softened. "I'm starting a support fund for victims. People who fell for scams. No judgment. No shame. We raise money privately and help with rent, groceries, basics. Thought maybe you'd consider joining our committee." Robert looked down at his hands. For years, those hands had built homes. Later, they clicked on promises disguised as investments. Now they held nothing but stillness. "Why me?" he asked. "Because you survived it," the man replied. "And you didn't disappear. People need to see that." Robert didn't agree right away. But he didn't say no. Somewhere deep inside, something small stirred, not hope, exactly. More like a seed of usefulness. It surprised him. He let the feeling stay. Scene 3, The Bureau Briefing. Clara Mendez stood at a podium in a briefing room at FBI headquarters. Behind her, screens showed maps dotted with glowing clusters, not unlike constellations. A strange beauty, if you didn't know what it meant. This time, the mood was different. People were listening. "We dismantled 3 major compounds in Southeast Asia. Dozens arrested. Hundreds rescued. Terabytes of evidence." Reporters scribbled notes. Cameras rolled. But Clara knew this wasn't the finish line. It wasn't even the middle. It was a page in a long book. "Let me be clear," she added. "What we are fighting is not a single organization. It is an ecosystem. We can slow it. We can punish it. But the only permanent solution is awareness, education, and vigilance. Someone raised a hand. Agent Mendez, do you feel this fight is winnable? She paused. A long, steady pause. Every life we protect makes it worth fighting. Not a slogan. Not a promise. A truth. Scene 4, The Bargain. In a holding facility in Phnom Penh, May sat across from a legal advisor and a translator. Her hair was tied back neatly, as though she wanted to appear smaller, cleaner, less dangerous. The detective slid a document across the table. Cooperation agreement. You provide details, chain of command, names, communication logs, account addresses, and you will receive consideration. May read it slowly. Her hand trembled. And if I don't? Then you go to prison here, the translator said. A long time. May closed her eyes. She thought of her parents back home, who believed she had landed a glamorous job abroad. She thought of the voices she manipulated, the lonely hearts she harvested like currency. I didn't start it, she whispered. But you continued it, the detective replied. Silence hung in the air, heavy as guilt. Finally, May picked up the pen. Tell me where to begin. Justice didn't feel triumphant. It felt tired. Necessary. Human. Scene 5, The Committee Meeting. A month later, Robert sat at a conference table in a library meeting room with five other committee members. There were no suits, no titles, no pretense. Just people trying to build something that felt like repair. A woman read through applications for assistance. This one's a veteran, she murmured. Lost $18,000. Lives alone. Another member spoke softly. We can cover 3 months' rent and utilities. Robert listened. He took notes. He didn't trust his voice yet. Didn't trust that it wouldn't break in the wrong place. But when they asked for volunteers to call recipients and deliver the news, he raised his hand. Everyone looked at him. Not pitying. Respectful. He nodded once. I can do that, he said. And he could. Scene 6, The Phone Call. Robert sat at home that evening, phone in hand. The first recipient was a retired postal worker named Daniel. He dialed the number. It rang twice. Hello. The voice sounded wary, as though expecting another sales pitch, another trick. Robert spoke slowly. Hi, my name is Robert Hensley. I'm calling on behalf of the Community Fraud Relief Fund. A pause. Is this about that thing I lost? Daniel asked quietly. Yes, Robert said. We reviewed your situation. We're able to assist you with living expenses for a little while. For a long moment, there was silence. He thought the call had dropped. Then a soft, cracked breath reached him. I didn't think anybody cared. Robert swallowed hard. I understand, he said. You're not alone. The conversation lasted only minutes. But when he hung up, he sat still for a long time, the room quiet around him. Helping didn't erase his loss. It didn't restore what was taken. But it built something else, dignity. Sometimes, dignity was enough to begin again. Scene 7, The Courtroom. Months later, in a federal courtroom in California, Trevor Briggs sat in a suit borrowed from a friend, his wrists chained under the table. The prosecutor read lists of accounts, victims, transfers. No theatrics, no anger. Just facts. Trevor stared straight ahead. Not defiant. Not remorseful. Just hollow. When the judge delivered the sentence, 22 years in federal custody, there were no cheers. No applause. One small headline the next day. A footnote in a much larger crime wave. Justice, in real life, rarely echoed loudly. But it echoed long enough. Scene 8, The Village Compound. Back in Southeast Asia, the compound May once worked and sat half empty. Equipment confiscated, windows dark, gates unlocked. A shell of deception, waiting for rust. Children rode bicycles past it, curious but unafraid. Locals said spirits lived there now, restless ones. Not ghosts of the dead, but ghosts of shame and fear and the lives that could have been. Every nation has ruins. Some crumble in sand. Some crumble in code. Scene 9, The Visit. On a warm spring morning, Robert drove to see Emily at her college. He hadn't told her he was coming. When she stepped onto the dorm steps and saw him, surprise lit her face, then joy. Dad? Everything okay? He nodded. Thought I'd take you to lunch. You free? She hugged him tightly. Yeah, I'm really glad you're here. They walked across the quad together. Students laughed nearby, backpacks slung over shoulders, futures ahead. Robert watched them, remembering the version of himself who once believed in shortcuts, fast wealth, quick victories. He no longer believed in sudden miracles. He believed in steps. In time. In effort. It wasn't glamorous, but it was real. Scene 10, The Testament of Quiet Things. That night, after returning home, Robert sat at his kitchen table, the same one where he had once stared at disappearing numbers. But tonight, the table held different things: a stack of workshop brochures, a notepad with volunteer hours, Emily's graduation photo in a small frame. He opened a journal he'd begun keeping, something the support group encouraged. He wrote slowly, "I survived believing in something false. I'm learning to believe in things that last. Work. Kindness. Caution. There is no quick road to freedom. Only the real one." He closed the book gently, not as a man finishing a chapter, but as someone placing a stone on solid ground. Scene 11, The Next Frontier. Meanwhile, in a sleek office in Singapore, a new tech founder pitched investors on AI-driven tokenized yield systems. Words that sounded brilliant and modern. The room applauded. Funds transferred. Some of it was legitimate innovation. Some of it wasn't. The cycle had not ended. It had only changed shape. Because scams do not die. They evolve. Just as those who fight them evolve. And the battle continued, not in dramatic bursts, but in steady vigilance. Closing beat, the long road. Weeks later, as sunlight warmed his balcony, Robert watered a small plant he'd bought the day he joined the committee, a simple ficus. It had grown. New leaves unfurled toward the light. He watched a neighbor walk a dog, kids chase a ball, the world move quietly around him. Ordinary life, unremarkable and therefore priceless. A voice echoed in his memory, from a film he once loved. Hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things. He breathed slowly, steady. Not hope for miracles. Hope for work, healing, and honesty. The kind that grows roots. Fade out. Roll quiet credits. End.